I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1992, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1992, here from our perch in 2023. I'm one of your hosts, Phyllis Gove.
And I am your other, I forgot my line, and I'm your special guest host, Emily St. James, sitting in for your regular host, the entire DEA.
Wow. That's a charge.
That was weird. I mean, it was like weird that you did a podcast with an entire federal bureau, so. But yeah.
Listen, they wanted to come on. What could I say? With us today is Robert Daniels, film critic, having written for the New York Times, Rolling Stone, Vulture, and IndieWire. Thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today, Robert.
Thank you for having me on, especially to talk about one of my favorite films of all time.
This movie, like, I know Phil's going to do preamble. This movie fucking rules. It's so good.
It really is. And I feel like, and Robert, you can obviously expound on this far more than I can, but like, this was a movie that, I mean, certainly existed, but it feels like it's had a real resurgence over the last few years. Obviously, the Criterion being sort of the somewhat pinnacle of that. But how did this movie come into your life?
Mine specifically, I've always been a big fan of Bill Duke as a filmmaker. I think Bill Duke is one of the great unheralded filmmakers, and one of the great like cinematic legends. You know, he as an actor, of course, he started off. He had his big breakout in film and Car Wash. So you got to go all the way back to 1976 for Bill Duke. But I also love him as a director. Of course, his first film, The Killing Floor, integrated union in Chicago in the early 20th century, a rage in Harlem, this sensual religious allegory, and then Sister Act 2, which is like one of the great Black musicals of all time. And so Deep Cover, actually I'd kind of known about the film, but you know, I'd seen a lot of, I think like most people had seen a few stills, and it did not look great in terms of the color timing, in terms of like the quality, and I was always like, I don't know. And then the Criterion restoration came out, and that's actually how I first watched it. Also, I think I had read about it, funnily enough, when it actually, now I'm really thinking about it, it really got on my radar because of Michael Boyce Gillespie's film Blackness, that book. And he has a whole chapter about Deep Cover. And I remember reading about it in that chapter being like, oh, this sounds like a really interesting movie. And then it just so happened, I think maybe a couple months later after I'd read it, the Criterion Restoration came out. And then that became my avenue to see it. And it's such a gorgeous restoration. And it really gets Bill Duke's exquisite use of color, especially within the noir genre, very well.
Yeah, it's a beautiful looking movie. I mean, full disclosure, had not seen this film prior to this. When it came out on Criterion and everyone was raving about it, it certainly was like on my radar, and I was excited for us to cover it on this. But to your point, there are several really beautiful sort of neon noirish sequences in this that just the punch of color and just beautifully, beautifully made. But Emily, you had not seen this film either, correct?
No, it was not a movie that was on my radar in 1992. I had heard about it when the Criterion came out, but I hadn't yet watched it. It really, like, I have a lot of problem with a lot of modern noir. Like, I think it's like, I'm glad people keep making them, but I have been, I was so impressed with how this hews to the noir like tropes while also like blowing them up and being interested in using them to examine a lot of different, like really weighty topics in a way where you like reach the end of the movie and you're like, oh yeah, like I thought about a lot of stuff, but you're never like, it's never like being heavy handed in any way, in the way that like a lot of modern noir will be like, and here's how you should feel about police corruption. And you're like,
no, absolutely.
Yes. Okay. But
yeah, it's very, I was surprised, especially with sort of like the last 20 to 30 minutes of the movie, how sort of morally kind of gray the whole thing became. Cause I do think that to your point, Emily, most noir falls into a very kind of like binary good and evil kind of thing. And I do think that this movie, it's just, I mean, the inherent institutions that it's questioning, the various things that exist, it's really deep, no pun intended.
Yeah. Like noir obviously plays in gray areas, but it's like, there's always a sense of what pole is good and what pole is bad. And this movie like keeps flipping that. It keeps being like, you know, what's the right thing to do? And there is no right thing to do, like most of the time.
Sure.
You know, where this movie leaves the Stevens character, Lawrence Fishburne's character, is so profound and like just like kind of a very small scale way.
It's also just really fun.
Yeah,
it's a fun movie. Yes. I mean, I think a lot of issues I have with like modern day noir is that it's far too dour.
Sure.
And you really don't get like the snap, the rhythm, the play that you would find in like the great noirs of course, the 40s and the 50s. But this one has it. And not only that, I like, Emily, as you point out, that like it really kind of blows up a lot of these tropes and like such a ecstatic and gleeful way. There's so many scenes in this that are literally laugh out loud funny. It's just an incredibly engaging, entertaining movie with fully realized characters who aren't just, you know, of course, like morally gray in the way that they're navigating through the world, but like you get the full sense of them, the full range of them as humans, and from their desires, which are, you know, nefarious, but then I think also like the love that they share among them, right? This is a film that has like, I think, one of the great cinematic bromances between Lawrence Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum. Yeah. So I think this is a film that, you know, of course has those noir sensibilities, but also has a lot of fun with them and plays with them in very interesting ways.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's worth, you know, you brought it up, but like Lawrence Fishburne and Jeff Goldblum, who are basically about to blow up, right? Like their career, they're about to become pretty massive movie stars for, you know, for all intents and purposes. And to see them sort of kind of at the tip of the spear as well, you're starting to get a sense that these two guys know that you can hang a movie on them. I mean, obviously Jeff Goldblum was in The Fly a few years previous, but still, like, you know, Lawrence Fishburne is about to become Lawrence Fishburne. He is dropping the Larry Fishburne. This is the last time he's known as that. But it's, I mean, first of all, Emily texted me this, but it needs to be said. Lawrence Fishburne looks incredible in this movie. He is just like gorgeous movie man. Star.
Yeah. Gorgeous. And and I like, yeah, I was watching the early part of this movie when he's talking with Charles Martin Smith and being like, he's very attractive. And my wife was watching it with me and she was like, wait till he has facial hair. Cause she had like watched the trailer. So I was like, oh, okay.
It really just chisels that jaw when he gets that, that facial hair. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
And Goldblum, you know, one of the big things I took away from this film too, was like, I wish Jeff Goldblum did more dramas. Cause like the guy's got chops and I feel like, you know, post Jurassic Park, everyone just sort of saw him as like, that's his lane now. And it's kind of a bummer.
Yeah. Yeah. There's obviously he has that same nervy quality.
Yeah.
And I looked back at like, there were a lot of negative reviews of this movie at the time. And a lot of them called out his performance as a thing they didn't like in it.
Really?
They were like talking about how it feels like a comedic performance, but like that's what works about it is it feels like he's like trying to charm you by being kind of like a slick, funny guy. But like there's a darkness underneath it that just isn't entirely connecting. I don't know if I've seen a better Jeff Goldblum performance. Like I love him in The Fly. That's like my other
really good in The Fly. Yeah. It is interesting what you're saying, Emily, that I think that some people just either couldn't lock into Jeff Goldblum kind of in the back half of this movie when his sort of sadistic darkness starts to really manifest. But I found that really fascinating. I just don't feel like we've seen him do that. I mean, he's now just kind of very approachable, which is fine. I mean, he's very funny. Don't get me wrong. But this movie shows that like there's another gear he could use.
Yeah, and I think approachable is a good word because he starts off this movie, I think, feeling very, I guess, innocent in some way, right? Because Barbossa comes to his door, what we assume is like a very like manicured, suburban, rich, probably more upper class than suburban, right? Like this very well-to-do neighborhood. And like he's wearing a sweater that's probably like a size too small. He's desperately trying to teach his daughter multiplication. And yet it feels like it doesn't feel like this is his actual family. It feels like he kind of like woke up out of a coma and just was stuck with this family. Like
it's like in The Lobster.
Yeah, seriously.
But I think the entire time, I mean, like, you know, like, I think the film is playing with that tension very, very early on of like the two lives that he has and really the life that he gravitates toward and is taken more with, of course, is this seedy underbelly and this like darkness that pervades this other world, this urban world. Of course, we get more about like his, the way he fetishizes, quote unquote, the urban, right? When it comes to like his sexual proclivity for Black women. And not even just like his attraction to Black women, but his like the way that he exoticizes, like even not just like how Black women look, but even intercourse with Black women, he sexually exoticizes. You get this like kind of like the tension that comes between, oh, should he live this white, kind of idyllic suburban life, or should he kind of go to his quote unquote baser instincts, right? And go to the more urban side, and the darker kind of elements of his character. I think this film is playing with that tension very, very well from the very beginning.
Sorry, go ahead.
This is me saying this, so you should not be surprised. There's a queer subtext to this movie, where it is like, obviously it is a bromance, as we said, between these two characters, but there is always like a weird sexual tension between them where you're like, are they going to kiss? And there's like a quality to how David is Jeff Goldblum's character. There's a quality to how David like exoticizes and fetishizes his partner in a way where you're like, oh, like he doesn't entirely understand, you know, his own feelings on all of this. I kept thinking about One False Move watching this, because that's another like really good modern noir, also directed by a Black filmmaker. And what I like about both those films is that in it, there's a main white character, Bill Paxton in that film and Jeff Goldblum in this, who like gets like 50% of the way to understanding the complexities of the situations he's in, but like just cannot look at his complicity in white supremacy, basically, and therefore like misses the big picture. Like the scene at the end where Jeff Goldblum's talking about how, you know, there's no race anymore, it's just rich and poor. Yeah. So we're on the same side. You're like, to some extent, like he's talking about the class war in like a way that makes sense, but also like, you know, he's blind if he doesn't think there's no race anymore. He can say that because he comes from a place where he's like a white man who can comfortably disappear into a suburban life, except he dies, so, you know, spoiler. Yeah.
Well, actually, I think that's my favorite line in the entire movie. I think about that line every single time someone rich says something absolutely out of touch and stupid. And lately it's been, you know, like people of color, even black people who've said, wealthy black people, you know, like say Rihanna, right, who went from this kind of like this like figure emblematic of like charity and these political causes, and then at some point the Super Bowl ad becomes a commercial for her brand, right? And how many, I think, black pop culture figures have gone from people who kind of rose up as these like radical black figures and now have just become parcels in capitalism. And so every single time that happens, I think about that line of like, there is no white, there's no black, there's no Hispanic, there's just rich and poor. And then at some point you get to this level of rich that not many people get to, where you have the comfort of not having to see race. You only see the bank, the numbers at the end of the bank account.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, it is sort of, it is fascinating the way that Goldblum perceives the world in a lot of ways, and his lack of self-understanding to some degree. Like, Emily, you were talking about the queer component and this sort of romance between the two of them, but I also couldn't help but feel like Jeff Goldblum or David is just so performative. There's so much of like the lady doth protest when he's talking about these sexual situations, which feels like this, he's constantly trying to prove himself as though he is, I mean, to some degree, obviously there is the rich element, but also just like the sexual proclivity, the prowess, all these kind of things just feel part and parcel of someone who's desperately trying to overcompensate for something. I mean, you can see the scenes where with Barbossa, where he's the hand slapping scene, and just this constantly feeling as though he's under the thumb of somebody, which he can't stand. There's also this, I don't know if it's a self-hatred, but like there is a little bit of the Judaism thing mixed into all of this as well, where like there's this sort of feeling as though he doesn't belong or as though he's lesser than. All that kind of stuff is playing into it, which is really fascinating.
Yeah.
I want to give a little bit of context to this film for the people that have not seen it.
I was leaving you a gap because I was like, Phil's going to want to give some context. So I was like, it's time for the context. Let's hear it.
David Jason, played by Jeff Goldblum, is one of the biggest drug dealers in Los Angeles. And Russell Stevens, played by Lawrence Fishburne, is an undercover cop who wants to bring him down. Posing as a dealer, Stevens begins to earn the trust of the LA drug underworld, eventually making his way to Jason himself. But along the way, he has to take his cover to depths he never thought he would have to see, including selling drugs and going to great lengths to eliminate potential competitors for Jason's drug cartel. Deep Cover opened on April 17th, 1992, against Basic Instinct, White Men Can't Jump, Beethoven, Sleepwalkers, and of course, The Mighty Ducks. What a murderer's row of movies. It was a different time, Robert. It would go on to make $16 million on an $8 million budget. It's got 87% on Rotten Tomatoes from critics, 77% from audiences. Roger Ebert gave the film 3.5 stars and said, "What sets Deep Cover apart is its sense of good and evil, the way it has Fishburne's character agonize over the moral decisions he has to make. Most drug movies are so casual about their shootings and killings that you hardly think it even hurt to get shot. Fishburne, faced with a situation where he might have to kill somebody, is deeply torn and he suffers agonizingly through the aftermath." I think that I agree with Ebert. And one of the things I do love about this film is, and you've both kind of mentioned this, but it's worth sort of unpacking a little bit more, is how much it blows up these tropes, right? And how much it makes these characters three-dimensional, so that you're really feeling the repercussions of these things. You're really feeling how torn they are. There's a shitty version of this movie, you know, a much more kind of like B version of this film, which has been made many times over. And it's a testament to everyone involved that this does not step on those landmines. It's pretty amazing.
I cannot believe this is an April film. Like, there's no like reason it shouldn't be released in April, but this, I watched this and I was like, this is like mid-August. This is the kind of movie you want to see in a multiplex in the middle of August when it's too hot to do anything else. And you go in, you watch this, and you're just like blown away by it.
Sure. Yeah,
April's like all wrong. I don't know. That's my note to New Line Cinema in 1992. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
I you know, you bring this up, Emily, and I think it's worth talking about for a second, which is the New Line Cinema of it all, right? I mean, New Line, which is a company, you know, was referred to as the, you know, the house that Freddie built. It was a company that really was sort of, you know, its currency was horror films. This is the third credit that Mike DeLuca has, and it becomes sort of the beginning of that transition. 94, you've got The Mask, which is a big hit. You've got sort of the Jim Carrey stuff, and then obviously Seven, which is sort of the really, that's the moment. But it is interesting that this film, as we speak of its layers and its intentionality and all these things, that it is one of the first, you know, substantive New Line movies. It is interesting in that respect.
This is a total tangent, but I wanted to ask Robert how you feel about Seven. I recently rewatched it, and it feels like this movie I watched and was like, they're kind of in a weird conversation just because there's this boomlet of movies that are like, this urban landscape is a hellscape and you need to escape it. And both Seven and Deep Cover are saying different things
and
about
black and
that.
White leads on top of everything else. Yeah.
This is true. This is true. Like, I'm wondering how you feel about Seven. What a great topic.
Well, I love Seven. But I think that they also, both films kind of, they treat law enforcement in the same way, right? These cops who are trying to stop this crime from happening, but ultimately they become stained and enveloped by this crime. And then of course in Seven, there's a big difference between, there is a difference between Brad Pitt and not Brad Pitt. Why am I blanking out with
Morgan
Seven?
Morgan Freeman, Kevin Spacey.
No, yes, it is Brad Pitt in Seven, right?
Yeah, it is.
Why did I like memory wipe him from Seven? I don't know. But yes, there is a difference between Brad Pitt and of course Kevin Spacey, right? Sure. I mean, Brad Pitt's not cutting off people's heads, right? But he still becomes like in some way permanently and morally scarred in the same way that in a similar way that Lauren Fishburne's character becomes morally scarred by the end, where he comes in hoping that he can stop this thing, but ultimately he finds out that there's a part of his soul that is this thing. I can definitely see, I agree, I can see why they're in conversation. Not the film I would think of, Emily.
Listen, I just rewatched Seven for a project my wife and I are working on, and I was like, I really am struck by how much DNA of that movie is in everything now. It just is.
Yes.
We're influential in a way I hadn't thought about. I honestly, thinking about that now, the Morgan Freeman character and Detective Taft in this movie kind of feel like they're in conversation. Also, Clarence Williams III, who was from the Mod Squad.
Indeed.
This is a sidebar, but like, this movie uses casting Deep Cover, to be clear, so well.
Yes.
It's a lot of like people who are from TV. And if you're going to the movies in 92, you probably know them. You know, like Clarence Williams is from the Mod Squad. Gregory Sierra is from Barney Miller. Like, there's Charles Martin Smith has been in 10 billion things.
Yeah,
there's somebody here who was the old woman at the place that Stevens moves into is from Bewitched. Like, it's a movie that's like using faces you probably know from like other contexts in ways that sort of help root you. I think this movie is incredibly well cast beyond the two leads, which is like not always the case with sort of movies at this budget level at this point in time.
I think that speaks also to Bill Duke's, you know, history in television, right? Directing, acting in TV, all those sort of things as well. Mm-hmm. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut
you. You also get the opening scene, which kind of makes this a Christmas noir with Glenn Turman. Like Glenn Turman is like one of the great unheralded like black actors of all time, just a brilliant character actor. And like to think about like the gap between this and like say Coolie High, it was like very fascinating. But like the way that he like, I think you know, every single time I watch this film, I've seen Deep Cover now I think 5 or 6 times. Every single time I watch this film, I think the first time I watched it, I thought, oh, this opening's a little hokey. Not sure if I totally kind of buy it. It's almost a tad overwrought. But each time I watch it, I vibe with it more, and I understand like I see more of the emotional grounding that it really gives the Lawrence Fishburne character in, of course, in terms of like him trying not to be his father, but ultimately in some way becoming his father by the end. But also just how hard of a job Glenn Turman has, that he has one scene to really land the entire kind of moral ethos of this film and do it in such a like a heartbreaking way. I, you know, like his death scene, the way he just kind of fades off, it's just, it's gorgeous. It's brilliant physical acting. And yeah, I think in a lesser actor's hands, it would be hokey. In a lesser actor's hands, it would be overwrought. But there's a great depth and tragedy to it. And I think seeing him in a film, say like Coolie High, which is really also about these young black men trying to evade their area, and seeing him as an older black man now, being someone who couldn't escape. I think that adds an extra layer of heartbreak in terms of like the casting the actor, our perception of the actor to the role.
Yeah,
absolutely. And I mean, not to be superficial about this, but there is a part of me as well that I always find scenes of parents doing drugs in front of their kids to be just really heartbreaking. Mm-hmm. There's something about that scene of, you know what I mean? This kid obviously knows that that his father shouldn't be doing this. The father is saying, don't do this. Like, this is bad. Don't do this. There's just something always very kind of, it just always kind of breaks my heart. And you see it also deeper in the film as well, when you have the character, the neighbor of Russell's and her son. Forgive me, I'm forgetting the character's name off the top of my head now. Yeah, God, what's her name? It doesn't matter.
I'll find it. I have the Wikipedia page open right now.
Thank you for that, Emily. I feel as though there's this sort of, there's a little bit of a mirror going on there. I think obviously there's the little boy that James, that I believe Russell adopts at the end of the film, which feels like a mirror to when he was younger and trying to be a better father figure. All that kind of stuff. But again, like all of these things could seem super tropey and could feel kind of, but this film imbues them with so much life that I just was really blown away by it.
Yeah.
And also, oh, sorry, I don't mean to cut you off.
Go ahead.
Yeah. No, I mean, it also starts at the most like kind of, in a film about the perils of capitalism inflicting black and brown people in urban areas. It begins on the most extreme, the most capitalistic holiday, Christmas. And the fact that, you know, Glenn Turman, I mean, basically I think that the heartbreak of it is, of course, that he does drugs in front of his kids, but the heartbreak of it is that like he clearly has spent all his money on drugs.
Yes.
And yet he's still trying to rob this corner store or liquor store. And in order to get money for Christmas for his kids, so he can still participate in this like kind of like capitalistic treadmill, right? And so like I think it really kind of from the very beginning in terms of the themes of the film really gets you, starts from the very extreme of capitalism, and then by the end we get to the same kind of extreme in terms of like how much capitalism has broken this man's soul.
I've forgotten what we're talking about, but were you thinking of the character Belinda? like.
Yes, I was. Oh, yes. Thank you. I
Great.
Appreciate that.
There we did it. I found it. I found it. No, but to your keep point, the Wikipedia Robert, open.
I appreciate that. To sort of piggyback on what you're saying, Robert, I feel like so much of this movie is about systems that are broken. If it's the political system, even if it's the drug trade, all these, like, it's all fucked, right? And it's like, it's all lose-lose, and you're all just kind of doing the best you can under the circumstances. And I do feel like, not to say that his father is succeeding within these systems, I don't think he is, but it is showing how sort of, how everyone is trying in their own way to kind of get by. And it feels like, I mean, even the question ultimately that's posited at the end of the film is just like, yeah, I've got this money, but like, I'm kind of fucked no matter what I do with it. And like, yeah. What would you do with it? Like, I think that that's, I think it's a brilliant, brilliant way to end the film.
He lays the blood soaked money on this grave and it kind of blows away in the wind. Yeah. It's ephemeral. Yeah. And then he walks away and we get one last shot of him and it pans up to like a figure of an angel covered in bird shit. And I'm like, what the fuck is this movie? It's so good.
I mean, it really is. It's, and part of it too is like the, you were talking, Robert, about the opening, but prior to the opening, you have this, the energy of those opening credits, that amazing music cue. This movie's just so propulsive on top of everything else. And it's, and I know that maybe this isn't important, but I think it is, but like, it's a really cool movie. Like, it's a movie that's also exuding with like, isn't this cool, right? Which I think is also part of the paradox of it, right? Like, I think that part of it is about Lawrence Fishburne's character is kind of awesome. Like, I don't know how else to say it other than he kind of is.
He's hot. That's the way, it's just objectively hot, this whole film. Yeah. All the fits. He has the best fits in this film. I mean, I was watching a film with my partner Mariah E. Gates earlier today, and to see the last shot where he's like walking out of the frame, I looked at her, I was like, does anyone ever look cooler walking out of a frame?
I mean, that's like, I took a picture of Lawrence Fishburne that I sent to Emily as I was watching it, which is before he kills the other drug dealer in the bathroom, he is wearing the most plunging quote unquote shirt you could, it is barely covering any of his chest. And I was just like, this, look at this guy. Like, it's fucking amazing. He pulls that off. That's not easy.
It's I mean, I'm in awe of all the performances in this movie, but also just like, yeah, once he gets the facial hair, I just got to return to that point. It's just something else.
But I think it's also worth noting, too, that like, I'm watching this film, obviously knowing these iconic performances from these two guys that have already happened, right? And I watch this film and I'm just like, yeah. Like, anyone else could play Morpheus, right? Like, is there any, like, obviously it had to be Lawrence Fishburne. He's the coolest fucking guy in the world. it's really interesting how, like, this is his first leading role, if I'm not mistaken. Like, this is the first, like, is it? Or maybe I'm wrong, Robert.
School Days, I think.
Sure.
Yeah, I would probably count him as the lead in School Days. Okay. Just because I think we're seeing the HBCU through his eyes. But yeah, this is basically his second leading role. I mean, he had like parts in Boys in the Hood, of course, and Color Purple. But yeah, I think this is like, I think we could call this like his first like clear lead. I mean, in basically a two hander.
And it's like, clearly pitched as like his movie star breakout in a way that some of those others weren't.
Especially like, you look at the poster and like, it's Lawrence Fishburne's head, right? Like, the majority of this is like, look at this guy. And then right after this, What's Love Got to Do with It? He's playing Ike Turner. And it sort of, it feels like then he's just a leading man, right? Like, then basically from that point on. It's also, so I wanted to talk just for a second about the Jeff Goldblum of it all, because he's in a lot of movies before this. And The Fly is in 86. And obviously he's the lead of that. but it doesn't really stick in a weird way. Like
it's like I think it's that thing like Robert Englund, where he could never play other parts because he's so covered in makeup in The Fly, you kind of don't get to know him. Like obviously he's in first half of that movie, but then like the parts of his performance that are the most impressive, he's covered under goop. And I love the goop, to be clear, but
great goop. Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, The Fly happens, but then it's like Earth Girls Are Easy, where he's sort of one of an ensemble, a very strange movie. You know, he's in The Tall Guy where he's the lead, but it doesn't movie that really sticks. And it's really not until this that he gets another big sort of juicy two-hander. And then Jurassic Park is obviously in 93. And then, you know, then it's off to the races and he's kind of doing whatever he wants from that point on.
One thing about these guys is they have both been around a lot longer than people think they have, because they break through in the early 90s. But like Lawrence Fishburne's in fucking Apocalypse Now. He's been working since he was 11. Jeff Goldblum is in Nashville. It's like they have had careers. And then in the early 90s, America was like, it's time for these two guys to be stars. And I don't disagree. Thanks, America.
But it is amazing. They both have like 15 to 20 years almost of like credits prior to them breaking out. It's pretty crazy. Fishburne is one of those guys that, I mean, what are the best voices ever? Like, especially when you get to have this much VO and you're just like, give me more voiceover from Lawrence Fishburne. He should be just narrating everything.
I kept thinking about how good he is in the TV series Hannibal.
Yes.
Watching this, there's just a quality to him. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Hollywood's over-reliance on law enforcement figures is a whole thing. But I kind of feel like Lawrence Fishburne should be like the only person who plays law enforcement figures, because he's like so good. He's so good at capturing the nuances. Like he's a good guy in Hannibal in a way that he isn't here, but he still is capturing like the ways that if you are actually a good person working in this job, the weight of it gets to you so much that you eventually just become like terminally sad all the time. And this movie, he just like kind of gives up on the system in a way that I found really refreshing.
Is this your favorite Lawrence Fishburne performance, Robert? Would you say?
Oh, that's... Huh. I would say yes. I mean, I think it's definitely the film where he has the greatest emotional complexity. I mean, of course, he breaks out in What's Love Got to Do with It, but I mean, Ike Turner's basically kind of a one-note monster that he kind of makes into something more, Lawrence. And then School Days, he's fantastic in School Days, of course, but I think it's this and Othello. I think those are kind of like the two, like in terms of like the pinnacle of like Lawrence Fishburne, and using the entire mystique of Lawrence Fishburne, because he's just like every single time he like glances at you, the way he's able to play emotionally with his eyes, which is on full display here, where you know he's either when he's flirting with the art dealer, and then when he has his neighbor trying to sell her kid, and like the way he's able to deploy his eyes, and really like I think for the most part like his lower face is usually pretty frozen, he just lets his eyes project kind of every kind of interiority to him. I think it's certainly this film and Othello that gives him like the biggest emotional range and the most like fruitful characters who are complex on the page, and he's not having to do more than what's on the page.
I really love him. I think both of those are better than this performance, but I really love him in Matrix Reloaded, the second one, where he has to play, he's playing a crisis of faith, but he also has to play a guy who doesn't think he's capable of having a crisis of faith. It really gives him a lot of notes to play in the way that the first and third movies don't as much. I really liked Yahya Abdul-Mateen in the fourth one, but I just would love to see.
Yeah, it would have been nice to have him back. You know, speaking of his eyes and just his, what he can convey without words, I was thinking about the scene when he has to kill the other drug dealer in the bathroom, and it's so messy and clumsy, and you can tell that he doesn't really want to do this. And it really felt so human and sad, and kind of I would argue kind of the moment when the whole thing kind of gets away from him. And by that I mean the character losing his compass entirely. I thought it was a fantastic scene, and I also think that this movie has sort of bursts of violence that are very intentional and very effective. You know, thinking about like Eddie's beating at on the pool table, even the father's killing in the beginning, I was surprised by like how much blood there was. Taft dies at the end as well, like the blood is just very realistic. Mm-hmm. Which I found really powerful.
I want to talk a little bit about Taft, because he's
please
kind of low-key
your favorite character.
He's my favorite character, but like he's like when he first comes into the movie, there's an energy to him where you're like, is this going to be kind of a comedic like sure. performance? And he is willing to lean into like kind of the ridiculousness of this like guy who's such a straight arrow that, you know, mm-hmm. everybody on the force like has mm-hmm. jokes about him behind his back. But as the movie goes on, he becomes like the one stable thing you can rely on. He'll come into a scene and just be like, you're making the wrong choice. And as the movie goes on, you're like, you know what? He is. But also, is there a right choice, Officer Taft? I submit that there is not. And like, by the time he's like charging this huge drug deal by himself, like you really have come to feel for this guy and believe in him as like the closest thing the movie has to a moral compass outside of Gopher, of course.
We're going to talk about Gopher, because Gopher, we need to unpack Gopher. But
yeah, Taft some more, yeah.
I want to talk Taft for a second, because I do feel like we've talked about this. We talked about this a little bit, but like TV actors versus movie actors. And sometimes there's a real sense of comfort that comes with a TV actor that just feels like someone who understands the role and you have a relationship with to some degree as an audience member. And I feel like there's something about Clarence in this film that just feels very lived in and comforting. And part of it is the fact that he has this father figure-y kind of component to him in terms of his relationship with Russell, especially near the end. Would you agree that there's a father thing there?
Just to quickly point to this, there's also a connection between Terman and him in the casting, because they're both sure. figures you know a lot from a lot of, like, they played a lot of characters in films. They've been in a lot of sure. black films from black filmmakers and that system. And, like, there's a link between them already in your brain that sort of like sure. lets you get to that father figure section, but go ahead.
That's interesting for me. It's interesting for me, because I think the first thing I saw Clarence in was not the Mob Squad. It was actually in Tales from the Hood.
Oh yeah.
Which follows a couple years after this. And he's so theatrical in Tales from the Hood. And so like seeing him in this, and it like, almost like, I mean, it's like there is kind of like a similar wavelength to the two characters, in terms of like, I think they're like, there's their earnestness. And both, I think, characters in Deep Cover and Tales from the Hood are also very religious characters, deeply religious characters too. And so like the first time I saw Clarence Williams, I kind of thought it was going to be a bit like, I think yeah. you're right. It does kind of like initially lulls you into thinking that this might be a comedic performance. Mm-hmm. I think especially if you're coming into this retrospectively seeing the roles that he would take later. But he's so like earnest and believes so much that like him as this one black man in this system can change everything. And yet he doesn't know that the system is really what he's fighting against and not these individuals. He's so earnest in that belief that he is the moral center of this film, and you do feel for him as he's like lying on the ground and he's like spitting blood as he's saying the Lord's Prayer. I mean, but it's like, you know, like I think it's like a very like touching scene, especially because of course we see this Lawrence I'm blanking on his character's name. But Russell, we see Russell, losing this second father figure, and a father figure who, even as he's lying on the ground, like, still fully believes in this, like, this religious mission that he has to somehow, you know, purify the Black community from quote unquote drug war that's happening.
Yeah, I think what's neat about this movie is that it never entirely buys into Taft's way of thinking, but it buys into the idea that having a moral compass is probably a good thing, and like that, like is a thing that like keeps him from either lapsing into parody or becoming like a scold in a way that the movie couldn't bear. Like, it's a really deft bit of performance, especially, but also I think the script is very smart on how it uses that character.
You also have sort of this, because his, and forgive me if I got this wrong, because this is the only part of this film that I got a little bit confused by, if I'm being honest. His partner was an informant. Am I correct? Hernandez, which is Taft's partner, is working with the drug dealers. Am I correct in that assessment?
I think so.
Okay.
That,
okay.
That is intentionally a little bit muddy. Yeah.
It's a little, yeah. So there is kind of, cause like his partner fucks up a bust at one point intentionally. Mm-hmm. And I only bring this up just because it does feel like
selling a little or a lot. Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
It does feel like that hurts Taft. Like, it does feel as though he really believed in his partner as well. Like, the Taft doesn't even have the comfort of knowing his partner is on the up and up, which I thought was kind of interesting. But that being said, I want to talk Gopher for a second here, because I feel like we need to talk about Gopher.
Yes. This is our new feature, Emily's Gopher Corner.
Gopher Corner. It's Emily's new podcast. We need to talk about Gopher. Gopher to me is in a different movie. I love him, but I don't understand what movie he's in.
Listen, I watched this movie, the very first scene he's in. I was like, I love that this movie has kind of a gay Danny DeVito. Like, that's great. And then I realized I knew him from other things, so I felt bad for calling him that. But like, that is very much pitched. It's like, well, you know, he's kind of the comic relief. One of the things I love about this movie is the tiny concessions it makes to being a movie. It is mostly very interested in presenting this very dark, nihilistic view of the way that the drug war has just like utterly hollowed out America in every aspect. But occasionally it'll just be like, here's a shootout, here's a movie thing, and Gopher is one of those things. There's no reason he should be there. He doesn't really, like, you're kind of like, what's he doing? And then at the end of the movie he's like working with Stevens and you're like, great, I love this for him. Gopher is a perfect character. Yes, he seems like belongs to a different movie, but like, it's important that he be there to just be like this like force of like, right, I am watching a movie is meant to be entertaining, you know.
Sure.
Basically,
here's what I need to know: how did Gopher get into this business? Because Gopher doesn't seem built for the criminal underworld.
We're not doing. They're doing slap cams, and Gopher's like, "Oh no, first one."
is what it's I like, mean.
In terms of like a scale of violence of 1 to 10, like the slap hand scene begins as like a 2. And he's just like so squeamish. I mean, I guess we're supposed to kind of like assume that he has seen Barbossa do this before and that he knows where this is going to end up. But it's like, but he's also seen him do this before. So why isn't he like desensitized to it? And instead, he still has like some kind of like little like soul to him.
He does. When he screams Felix, you really feel like it's hurting him.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just,
and to your point, Emily, just before I wanted to say, when he shows up and he's the one sitting in the back of the convertible as they pull up, like I was just like, Gopher, why are you here? What are you doing? But anyway,
yeah, it's a very classic. Okay, who's still alive? You know, correct, that kind correct. Of thing.
Yes,
that like
yes.
is either who's still alive or who isn't like so burned that they can't yes. appear in a session like this. And it's basically just Gopher. And you're like, well, of course it's Gopher. And anyway, he eventually is elected to the United States Senate and actually has some really bad policies. And like people don't like we don't talk about that part of Gopher's career, but this is clearly the high point of his life.
I mean, it's incredible is what it is. I mean, it's,
I really thought he was Charles Nelson Reilly for like a little bit. I love, but yeah, like he is this. Yeah. It shouldn't work. The thing about this movie is it makes so many choices that shouldn't work and they all do. And I feel like I haven't seen Bill Duke's debut, but I feel that way also about Sister Act 2, which has come up a lot on this podcast.
It really, we talked about it a lot. Because we did cover Sister Act.
But it seems like it's come up in several unrelated episodes. At least people this one. It. Yeah. It's a great movie, but yeah, I feel like that's another movie that like is always making some interesting choices and they don't all work in that movie, but they're all like cool.
I was just thinking about in my head like how out of place Gopher is, and then I started kind of like imagining him at the end of other noirs. Like, could you imagine him at the end of like LA Confidential? Like, just insert Gopher at the end of LA Confidential.
It's first of all, the actor who plays him, I was trying to place him, and then Emily told me that he's in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which makes sense. He has a very very specific disposition, let's just put it that way, and line delivery. I want to know who else auditioned for Gopher, right? Like, was this like, oh, it's just a very interesting personification of a character that I'm just like, I don't really get it, but I'm into it.
I think it's an interesting, this movie has a lot of casual homophobia, as you'd expect out of this world. Sure. Like, I don't think it's like a choice that is like made out of malice. It's a choice that's made out of accurate depiction of the world. There's a lot of racial slurs as well, occasionally delivered by white people in ways that are like horrifying and to the point. And I felt similarly about every time someone said the F slur in this movie. There's a horrifying quality to it that I think the movie understands. And I think Gopher, who is very queer coded, you know, is like there as kind of a depiction of like, you know, what is it like to survive as a queer person in this world? Because it's a topic the movie can't actually tackle, but it feels like that performance is there to be like, here's a little just nugget of to leave you thinking about this question.
Yeah, I think particularly how this fits in Bill Duke's career, since you briefly mentioned Sister Act 2. When I think about something like The Killing Floor, which is a film that I think in from The Killing Floor to this, into including Sister Act 2, is that Bill Duke is very interested in the limits and potentiality of integration. And what does that mean when Black and white people, queer people, brown people, you know, like, and different religions are kind of thrown together. And that's why I think that line about like there are no Blacks, there are no whites, there's no Hispanics, there's only poor and the rich is so fascinating. Because I think outside of Sister Act 2, which is, I think, really totally about the potentiality of integration, both this and The Killing Floor are about its limits and how far can it take you, and what are the realities of this world that everyone's contending with, what is the racial implications the sexual implications, how do systems kind of put barriers that around integration that makes the idea of integration or fantasy of integration, we fantasize it of it as nearly impossible in a world that doesn't really care about it. It cares basically about the dollar and that's it. Mm-hmm. Which is what makes like Sister Act 2 so fascinating, is that he gives into it. I actually interviewed Bill Duke, this time last year actually, about Deep Cover, and he talked about how early in his life he of course grew up with segregation, right? But some of the biggest breaks that he had in his life actually came from white people. And he talked about like the tension between those thoughts, right? Like, oh, you know, like I've been taught that white people are evil, but then these white people help me. And trying to kind of cohere those two different things, right? Of between like there's clear racism, but then there's this maybe integration is something that is possible on a person-to-person level. And I think all, particularly in the early part of his career, he's really always revisiting that kind of tension between the like systematic idea of white people and then the on the personal level of white people.
Yeah. And I love the way this movie tackles that, because you know, racism is a systemic force. Any prejudice in our society is systemic, whether it's misogyny or transphobia or whatever. But then like there is this element of person to person communication where you can really get to know someone and still participate in deeply prejudiced, deeply horrible systems and yet be like, but I like that guy, therefore I am not X, you know? So I think this movie, like the relationship between Fishburne and Goldblum in this movie, captures that really beautifully. And I'm similarly to the relationship between to return to One False Move, the relationship between Bill Paxton and the lead actress in that film. Whose name I blanked on because I don't have the Wikipedia page open.
I will find it.
But yeah, it's this complicated dance both of these movies do, and I think noir is the perfect genre to examine those questions because noir is so interested in the ways that the system is constantly rigged against everybody.
Cinda Williams was the actress
Williams
in One False Move. But I agree with you, Emily, and I think it's also interesting. There's that moment in the film where Fishburne goes to pick up Jeff Goldblum, who's had some sort of illicit affair with a black woman of some sort, and they have this conversation where he's like, why do I love having sex with black women so much? And Leonard Fishburne is like, because of the whole slave thing, and he doesn't want to like even acknowledge that, and it's kind of like almost like Jeff Goldblum plays it off as a joke, and it continues down the conversation as Jeff Goldblum continues to joke and Lawrence Fishburne continues to take it very seriously. And I think it's just a really fascinating kind of, it's not a throwaway scene by any means, but the fact that it's a conversation walking away from us, getting quieter and quieter as it happens, I think is very intentional. Like there is something very serious about this and people do not really want to challenge this idea.
Yeah. It feels like a scene that was in the screenplay, and then Bill Duke's like, you know, we can just let that go
we
off.
Let that trail there. Off down, yeah. Down the road. It's interesting though, because it is sort of, and it does speak to sort of One False Move as well, Emily, and the relationship between Paxton and Cinda as well, like of just that, like the dichotomy and the unfortunate reality of the way that some white people can't really, you know, grapple with these things. It is interesting. And I think this movie does a great job of sort of, I think that Goldblum's character, his descent into sort of his downward spiral is tragic, but also just so kind of the way it needs to be. I mean, I it feels, anyway. Yeah.
Can we talk a little bit about Michael Tolkien,
the
co-screenwriter of this, who's having a great run at this point?
Is.
In time. In 91, he directs and writes The Rapture, which is one of my favorite movies about religion. So good. And then this year he has The Player and Deep Cover, and obviously The Player he gets so much acclaim for.
Sure.
He's written
based
a lot
on his
of
book.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. He's written a lot of neo noirs. The Player has noirish aspects, even though it's a comedy in most ways. it just feels very weird to me that he co-wrote this movie. It's just like, there's just something about it where I'm like, okay, sure.
I also don't know the other writer. I mean, by that, I mean, I don't know his work.
Henry Bean.
Bean, also a novelist.
And he wrote a bunch of, neo-noirs as well. So I guess that's just like the thing. Yeah.
And this was, it should be said, for what it's worth, this was originally going to be a sequel to Internal Affairs.
Wow.
So take that for what it's worth.
What?
So, that is a original sort of iteration, if you will. I think it started as that. And then I think Tolkien probably comes in and does the rewrite, and that's where we are. But yeah, Tolkien, having a moment.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating to think of the writer of Deep Impact with a whole lot of N words in script.
Yes. Correct. He did write the movie, a kind of underrated film, Changing Lanes. You guys ever see that movie? Oh, yeah. The Ben Affleck, Samuel Jackson movie.
Yeah.
Yes. I actually kind of recently rewatched that. Like, I think like 3 months ago, at my day job, they had it on in the background. I was like, is this Changing Lanes? I haven't thought about this movie in like 3 years or
something. It is fascinating, to your point, Robert, that this guy really wants to kind of dig into racial disparities that exist in America. But he does seem to kind of want to do that. I mean, Changing Lanes and this movie are both sort of grappling with those ideas.
I think Changing Lanes is, I haven't seen that in so long, and it's okay. You know, it's pretty good.
Sure. It's an above average, you know,
it is really the difference. Like, it's directed by the guy who made Notting Hill.
Correct.
Who's a white guy from South Africa, which is another country that obviously has a long history of racial problems, racism at an institutional level. And really the difference between that movie and this movie is just like the perspective of the director. And I'm always kind of loath to give too much to the auteur theory, but like you could watch these two movies in a double feature and have a reasonably good time and still be like, okay, yeah, I see what the director really brings to a movie like this.
It should be said that Tolkien's last credit as of now is 9. So everyone's favorite movie that totally doesn't exist.
Oh, Phil, you have missed that he wrote the Making of the Godfather miniseries, The Offer.
Oh, shit. I missed
and
that.
Yeah. Also, Escape at Dannemora. He's apparently just like gone off to just do things for the Paramount.
Listen, Escape at Dannemora is
a company who does
good.
Amazing things.
He's also written some Ray Donovan. I missed his TV credits. Yes. But 9 is a movie that I hope to talk with you about at some point, Emily, possibly in the future. Who knows? Yeah. Anything's possible.
It's time to announce in the new year, we're changing this to podcast like it's 9 and we're just talking about 9.
It's just a podcast about 9. It's a podcast for nobody.
Any movie with 9 in the title, or that is the 9th in a franchise. Yeah, it also counts, but mostly we talk about the 2009 major motion picture 9.
I do think, though, to get back to Deep Cover, that there's kind of this, I mean, there is a pulpiness to this movie as well. And I feel like the most kind of, I don't want to say funny or unintentionally funny, because that's not really true, but like Barbossa's death did make me laugh, because
it's so funny.
Dummy that just gets fucking hit by a car.
Yeah,
but the editing in that scene is so tight. I mean, it's so tight, and some of it is meant to be fun. I'd be like, Lawrence Fishburne does that like high pitched scream, you know, and like Jeff Goldblum just seems like he's riffing on, riffing on shrimp.
That whole sequence was like, this is crazy. What is happening right now?
I will say this for that sequence. You absolutely can follow the geography of everything that's happening.
Absolutely.
And maybe some of that is I live like a mile from the shooting location, so I've been there all the time. I've driven through that tunnel. But also, it is so clear and who's in relation to who and where. And like, you know, in this era where people frequently complain about action sequences where you can't understand what's happening.
Yes.
I often am like, well, you know, you get the story gist, but then you see a one like this and you're like, mm-hmm. oh yes, absolutely. There is a difference between when everything's super clear from a filmmaking perspective and when it's just like kind of a muddle.
Bill Duke said, I think Bill Duke told me that he only lives a couple blocks from that tunnel. Like he knows that tunnel intimately. Like yeah. he's lived there almost his entire time he's lived in LA. And you can feel it. Like he knows the space and he knows how to play within space and how objects play within space. Not just, you know, in terms of like the car itself, but kind of like the emotionality and like how the actors play with the distance of the tunnel and the maneuvers within the tunnel. I mean, it's a very well crafted scene that is at once both funny with the dummy, yeah. but also like so well shot. Like that like low angle shot where you see like the red lighting behind Jeff Goldblum and he's somehow like eating like jumbo shrimp in hell or something like that.
it's got a very like manic tension to it. I don't mean to suggest that it's like laughable because it's not, but it is maybe the most dialed up part of the movie in terms mm-hmm. of just everything feeling really manic, which adds a tension and a fear to like, you just don't really know what's going to happen. And you also know that Barbossa's fate is tied to them, right? So like whatever yeah. happens to this guy is going to happen tenfold unto them. So like yeah. there is kind of that that tension that plays into it too.
I think
there's also the there's also, I just want to give props to James T. Morris, who is playing the character of Ivy, the rival drug dealer who is
yes.
persistently quoting Arnold Schwarzenegger.
He's great.
He is great, and he's another decision in this movie about like, you know, like these humanized characters, that he is like the most over the top cliche in the world and it should not work. Mm-hmm. And like, he's clearly there to kind of add some kind of like comedic, like kind of, you know, lightness to it. Mm-hmm. And yet it does work. Like that actor is so incredible in this role. And he is full commitment to every single line he is saying.
Absolutely. and also just like and this, again, not to say that this is a trope, but it is within the consciousness of these movies, which is these people don't care about murder, right? Like the fear of people that will sort of kill because why not type of thing. Like it has this, he feels so, like I think about the moment when he kills Russell's, drug dealer. I mean, I'm trying to think of like what her component is into his sort of, but like his work, one of his partners, I guess. And he feels that obviously this is when he has to kill Ivy, but there's just something about this, the joy to some degree that Ivy gets from killing, that is also just deeply upsetting. Yeah.
And I think partly the reason that character works, of course, because of the actor, James T. Morris, but also, I mean, it's that bathroom scene where even though this character is so clearly over the top, and I think actually is like the cliche of what, if you're a white person who's never seen a black drug dealer, this is the cliche you have in your head. Mm-hmm. And yet when Lawrence Fishburne confronts him, when Russell confronts him, he sees him purely as a human that he has to murder.
Yep.
Yeah. And so you have like the two different audiences within the film, right? You have this character that's clearly playing to the stereotypes that white people have about black drug dealers, and then you have the actual reality in which the way that Lawrence Fishburne's character sees this man, sure. that this is a real life that he is taking.
Yeah. A thing I look for a lot in a movie as someone who writes fiction in various contexts is every character feels like they have a point of view on the action, feels like they have an interiority, feels like they have a humanity to them. And this movie sails over that bar. Like, there are one scene characters in this movie where you're like, yeah, if this movie was from that person's perspective, it maybe wouldn't be as good, but it would be like an interesting movie. Like, even Mrs. G in the boarding house or whatever you like, mm-hmm. is just like, you know, what if this movie's about her? What a great idea. Sounds good. Like, sure. Everybody in this movie feels like a person. And it's a movie in a genre where you don't really need to do that to work. Like, you can just have it be a bunch of people be cannon fodder. But this movie is very interested in all the people who die. I have one other thing I want to say, but Phil, please go ahead.
I was just going to say that I wanted to kind of unpack the Carver character for a second, because it does feel like at this point in the film, this moment of when Russell realizes he's a pawn in a kind of a bigger game. And that sort of the political justice system, if you will, is broken, which is, I imagine, something he probably had an inkling of as he got into it, but that's neither here nor there. I do feel like Carver's character of sort of this basically explaining that sort of the State Department has decided that Gallegos is, all of these characters, all of these sort of people within the drug cartel could be helpful to them in some form or another. And it's sort of the moment when Russell kind of abandons his undercover status, quits being a cop, what have you. I just think the Carver character, which is ultimately like the beginning of this movie, of Charles Martin Smith, who's a great actor who I've loved him in many things, is just such a deplorable character in this movie, like so loathsome. It's again kind of playing against type a little bit, because usually plays like the nice kind of nebbishy, you know, whatever guy.
He usually plays this. Never Cry Wolf. That's just, I'm always sure, like, there's sure. Never Cry Wolf. Look at that.
Or the character from The Untouchables is the one that I often think of. Yeah. But yes. And to see him, I mean, quite frankly, just say the N-word several times right in this first scene, I found it very unsettling. And obviously he was doing it to get a rise out of people, to see what sort of emotions it would elicit. At the same time,
there's
the weaponization of that word is deeply upsetting.
There's also a certain kind of white authority figure who thinks they can say a slur as like a power play or like a way to like test boundaries. That is, you know who that kind of guy is.
Yes.
With every relationship in his life. He's always pushing your buttons because he thinks it's how he like figures something out about himself, but he really just likes having power, and he's a petty little tyrant.
He is God.
What did you think of Charles Martin Smith in this, Robert?
Oh, you know, I think he is. I think he's wonderful in this, as wonderful as you can be in such a deplorable character.
Sure.
But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, thinking back to, like, of course, to the drug war, right, where this film is very interested in, like, the stereotypes that we have of people who are in this war, right? Black drug dealers are the problem. We need to take them out. The good commanding cops and DEA agents are trying to clean up the streets, and that's how you get stuff that leads to, like, the crime bill, right? And so, like, to see a film that, like, fully and forcefully shows this character for what they probably are in real life, as, like, I mean, because you go through this movie and you start realizing that the biggest drug dealer in this is actually the U.S. government.
Yep.
and Smith, I think, plays that well in terms of being literally the emblematic of kind of like everything that we think of when it comes to the hypocrisy, right, of the system that is America. We have them using race in order to drive wedges into communities. We see him, of course, saying that he wants to clean up the Black community. When he has the lecture with Russell about, do you know what a crack baby looks like? Mm-hmm. You know, and plays on, In different ways, actually, if you think about him and Clarence, right, they're both playing on his emotions as a Black man, right, and using children to do that.
Yeah.
And then to see Clarence, who's very earnest, and of course is earnest for a system that he somewhat believes in, right? And matching that to Charles Martin Smith's character, Carver, right? Who is very deplorable in the way that he uses it and very manipulative in the way that he uses Black bodies mostly to get to his own endgame, which really involves him getting more power as a white man within the system, while he says him and Lauren and Russell are going to be a team, but we know that's not the case. That's never the case. It's very fascinating how the film, as I think Emily keeps saying, it could work on one beat. Every single one of these characters works on multiple beats and is emblematic of multiple either inequities within the system or are emblematic of the ways of the multiple ways that the system can inflict damage upon people.
Speaking of character actors who become directors like Bill Duke, we would be remiss not to mention Charles Martin Smith's directorial career, which is perfect. He made Air Bud, for instance. He made both Dolphin Tales. His most recent film is A Christmas Gift from Bob, which is about a cat who visits you on Christmas. Sounds good. Sounds great.
I think that movie was made for you, Emily.
I think so. It came out in the pandemic. If I had discovered it at that point in time, I would have watched it like 7 times and just like cried the whole time. So it's a good thing I didn't.
I do think everything you're saying is true, Robert, in terms of like what this character personifies within mm-hmm. the context of the film. I also just feel as though it's really good casting because he is just this like kind of sniveling little man, right? Like mm-hmm. there is just something very kind of like his physical presence, the way that he is always kind of trying to seem really big and powerful. I think about the sort of comeuppance that gets at the end of the film, where essentially he tries to use Betty as I guess basically leverage. Manipulates Betty, yeah, as to sort of fuck over Russell, and then Russell uses some videotape that got recorded of this mm-hmm. whole thing. I mean, it's a little bit of a deus ex machina, but I do think that like it works. One thing that I wanted to mention, which I kind of loved because I thought it was sort of absurd, is in the big sort of before the big shootout at the end, the moment when David is trying to convince these drug dealers to invest in his synthetic drug, a drug that I'm amazed doesn't already exist. I don't know, but whatever. And he has a prospectus. Like he literally has like documents and a whole like pitch doc for them. And I'm just like, what's happening?
I love it. So I was like, oh, they probably do have to have marketing plans for their new drugs. Like that's probably a thing they have to think about.
I just love that some graphic designer is like, I guess I'm making this pitch deck for this synthetic drug.
And it's just like a bunch of photos of like Goldblum, you know, he got like some glamour shots taken.
100%. 100%. I want to just talk for a second about we talked a little bit about it, but like the very last moment that this movie kind of ends on is basically Russell and James, the little boy that he's adopted because Belinda kind of disappears from the movie a little bit. And there's a little bit of sort of, I would have liked one more scene of her between kind of her trying to sell her kid. And then I want to say like 45 minutes to an hour later, she shows up dead. It would have been nice to have just seen a little, again, this is nitpicky, but it would have been nice to see one more scene with her.
Bill, yes, this is my one problem with this movie. Yeah. It's not a problem per se. It is within the film's worldview.
Sure.
But this is a movie that doesn't have a lot of room for women. Like they are on the edges of the story. Yeah. They have things to do. But Betty is such a formulaic character compared to a lot of the people in this movie. Like there's a world in which she's more of a femme fatale and it feels like they faint at that a little bit, but they're just, the movie kind of has women characters, but it is about these relationships between men, and that is fine. Like, as people who listen to this podcast know, I will come down hard on a movie if it just has like women there to be like the objects of men's affection.
And
this
like movie, Sensible, I think, Woman, for instance, Sensible Woman, maybe, mm-hmm, maybe. Mm-hmm.
This movie like has this movie has a larger like worldview, but within that larger worldview, it does seem like it's sort of like, yeah, women are there as like pawns in a weird, yes, way. And I think that's intentional, and I'm fine with it. But I'm also like, I wish some of these women had the same level of interiority that like every male character does.
Absolutely. I mean, I do think Betty, I agree with you, Emily. But I do think that performance wise,
She's great. Yeah,
she's great. And I do think that there does seem to be, she does have control of her destiny to some degree. Right. Like, I do like the fact that, you know, when she has that scene with Lawrence Fishburne, when she's like, are you still in the business or do we have a shot of being a couple? Because she does not want to be with him if he's still in the business. I do like the fact that there's a level of independence that exists with her character. Mm-hmm. But I agree with you, Emily, that I kind of wish that she wasn't just kind of a hot lady that's there, you know.
Yeah.
But, but as I was saying, that you do have this what was her character's name again, Emily? My apologies.
Belinda. See, you're making my point for me.
I know. She doesn't seem like a Belinda, is kind of what it comes down to.
Yeah. Like,
But that scene, I do want to just talk about that scene very quickly. There's this scene where she's clearly high and she's talking to Lawrence Fishburne, and the manic sort of switch, I think it's a really great performance, the way she's kind of ping-ponging between this an obvious kind of wanting to be there for her son and at the same time clearly having a serious drug habit that she doesn't know how to kick. There's just a lot in that scene that I thought was really rich and was really well performed and directed that I missed her, I guess, is what it comes down to, and I wish that we got one more scene with her. But what did you think of that performance, Robert, or that character?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Emily, of course, is correct about the that Betty, right, where it feels like she's supposed to be a femme fatale, and in some ways, of course, she, you know, the mask scene, right, is so important because this is a film entirely about people putting on masks, right, for being in the role of performance. And she fulfills, you know, the film in that kind of like thematic fashion, where we see her as like the cool collected art dealer, and then we see her and she is this person who's like, no, like this, I got my check, I just want to go, I don't, you know, like I'm actually an innocent, you know. But I do wish we got more with her. In terms of Belinda, you know, it's like kind of like, not to always bring every black film to Moonlight. But if you think about the character in Moonlight, the mother character, who's played by Naomi Harris. There we go. Boom. Couldn't come to my mind. But if you think about like that character, Naomi Harris, right, the way that you get like the full range of her as a mother, you know, she begins the film somewhat clean, somewhat thoughtful of her son, Chiron. And then we see the descent into her drug habit. And of course, we see her come out of it on the other end, but we see the full level of that descent and how much that, seeing that, humanizes her. And I agree that we are missing that from this film. And of course, Moonlight proved that you could do that with a supporting character. So it's not like this has to be her in order to do that. We really are kind of like missing one scene to fully make her into like a fully realized person. But I think the performance is, particularly in the scene where she's trying to sell her son, is really, really fantastic. I was thinking, I think when Samuel Jackson recently did an interview talking about like his role as the crackhead in Jungle Fever as compared to Chris Rock and New Jack City as Pookie. Who is like the most like stereotypical like crackhead in the world? And you see like he's just kind of like, he always has like this really like manic type. With her, I think her modulations are much better, of course, because I think she is bouncing off the walls. There is some lot what she's trying to do, where she plays it in terms of okay, maybe I can sell my body. Then she sell my son, and if she goes from like, you know, like from angry to almost like, you know, like I'm losing my words right now.
It's okay, no worries. Yeah, there's
from angry to pliant to, you know, like, and so there's a lot of like emotions that she's playing with in that scene, even though that I'm on the page, I bet you it only reads as one emotion, right? You know, sure. She still is able to find these kind of nooks and crannies to show the internal conflict going on within this woman who at once needs money for her next fix, but also now doesn't believe in herself as a mother, but still wants to take care of her kid. And so in some way she sees a guy who's like, might be a good father figure. this could be a win-win for both of us.
Sure. Forgive me just one quick second. My doorbell is ringing. I'll be 2 seconds. I'll be right back.
Wow.
Okay.
Sorry, guys.
This is the part where I just ask unrelated questions.
Yeah.
Sister Act 2. Let's talk Sister Act 2. Tell me what you like about Sister Act 2.
Oh, you know what? I actually like Sister Act 2 more than the first Sister Act.
Me too. And I
Yeah, no. And I mean, one of the primary reasons is because Miss Lauryn Hill is so fantastic in that movie. Yeah. But also, I like know that like what Bill Duke has created is somewhat of a fantasy world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In terms of this poor like integrated church, like a Catholic school in San Francisco.
Yeah.
I do like the earnestness in it. And I think he captures those like scenes, the scenes of like the joyful scene really, really well. And I also just think like there's like smarter kind of like comedic element to this, whereas like the first one, and I don't get me wrong, I like Whoopi Goldberg in the first one, but there is just kind of like there's this like odd minstrel element to the first one that like always kind of rubs me the wrong way. Whereas the second one, I think she is so comfortable within her star persona, so comfortable within this character and with this group of kids. And there's just this really good give and go between her and Lauryn Hill. And God, why didn't Lauryn Hill make more movies?
Yeah.
Like, why didn't she? She is an absolute star from the first second you see her. You're like, this woman should be, like, have like 5 Oscars lined up on a, like, on a mantle somewhere. And that ending is just, and plus, how many films do you see that reference Rilke? How many films?
I just like am imagining if you work at the Touchstone Company, the Walt Disney Corporation, and you're like, we need a director, Sister Act 2, we got to get this out soon because we got Whoopi, we got this window with Whoopi, and you see Deep Cover and you're like, that's our guy. Because like, you're right, they do have like a lot of thematic things in common, but like, this movie's like kind of a nihilistic like meditation, and that movie's like a real fantasy of like, what could the world look like if we really like, you know, valued each other.
So as we wrap up, we do a rating system on this podcast at the end of our episodes. I'm also curious to hear your thoughts on the movie we're covering next week, Robert. But I came into this, so we do two, sort of a pre-podcast and a post-podcast rating as to whether or not the conversation might have swayed you one way or the other. I mean, I came into this film at an 82, and I think I'm basically like, I'm at a maybe an 85 now, from 0 to 99. What about you, Emily? Where are you?
I came in at 96. I'm going to a 97. I have my little ranking on Letterboxd of like all the movies we've watched for this podcast.
Sure.
And I'm surprised at how much of my top 10 is movies made by people who traditionally weren't allowed to make movies in the studio system, who kind of had to find a way, or like this movie in Poison Ivy.
I was just going to say,
really
Poison
fucking
Ivy.
Loved. It's just like, there's this interesting examination of American power dynamics that a lot of the movies that were acclaimed at the time just haven't survived as well. You know, there's like Howard's End and Last of the Mohicans that are still great, but yeah. And also the queerphobia scale.
Oh, yeah.
Technically it's like a 5 because there is a lot of F slurs, but I feel like they're used with intentionality, and like just the presence of Gopher knocks that down at least a point. So
The Presence of Gopher, Emily's new book that's coming out soon.
On the Gopher scale, this is a 12.
Robert, where are you, 0 to 99 on this movie?
I would say before, I would say I was at a 97. I'm at a 98. This movie gets better with every watch. I realized I rewatched it earlier today this morning, and like, you wouldn't think this would be like something you would get up in the morning to watch. Damn, it plays at any time of the day. It plays at any time of the day. Just have this with a cup of coffee and just let it wake you up. It's a 98. It gets better on every watch.
I can't wait to watch it again very soon. Next week, we have BJ and Harmony Colangelo, co-hosts of the podcast This Ends at Prom. They came on to talk with us about John Woo's Hard Boiled. Do you have thoughts about that, Robert, by any chance?
I love Hard Boiled so much. so much. I mean, truly one of the great action movies of all time.
Incredible.
I mean, just, yeah, incredible. Like, I mean, every film, every action film that I watch, I'm just like, why isn't this Hard Boiled? Why? it's funny that like John Wick has become like the touchstone, and I do love John Wick, don't get me wrong, but for me, every single time I'm like, Hard Boiled is right there. Why don't people just copy it and just not even change a thing, just remake it, just keep remaking it.
Yeah. Just reshooting it shot for shot.
Yeah, just keep doing it.
And another movie with some real hotties in it. Like some gorgeous people in that movie. We recorded that at a time when my baby was still pretty young. And that movie has some fun baby stuff in it. So.
It does have. It's got a whole nursery sequence. It's unbelievable. Robert, on the John Woo scale, I'm assuming Hard Boiled is probably one of your tops, right? Do you have other John Woo favorites or...
Let's see. The Killer, of course. Sure. I love The Killer.
Are you a Face Off fan?
Who doesn't? Yeah, I was about to say it. Who doesn't love Face Off? I recently rewatched Face Off, I think last year, because Keith Phipps' book on Nicolas Cage, to promote it, he came to the music. He did a double feature at the Music Box of Matchstick Men and Face Off. And let me tell you, those two films play better together than you think.
Matchstick Men is underrated. That movie's legit.
Yes,
great. Yeah,
it's fantastic. Yeah. So no, I love Face Off. I love like living the two extremes of manic energy and the way that Travolta tries to play Nicolas Cage and Nicolas Cage tries to play Travolta, and really you just see that they're the same actor. Why did it take so long for any of us to see that these are the same actor with almost like the same kind of like range in terms of like emotion and range in terms of campiness? Like, absolutely. Brilliant.
Yeah, it is. It we talked about this on the episode, but you know, obviously John Woo's American films aren't nearly as strong as his home country films. But I hope
Mission Impossible 2 is there. Mission Impossible 2 is there too.
It is there. I can't say I ride hard for Mission Impossible 2, but I mean, listen, to each their own. But Robert, thank you so much for coming on and talking with us today. This was an absolute joy. I hope you'll come back in the future and talk with us.
Where can people find your work and find your wonderful self?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, you can follow me on the artist formerly known as Twitter. @812filmreviews. You can also follow me on Letterboxd at the same handle, and you can also follow me on Substack at the same handle. Every month I do a Substack that a newsletter that has basically everything that I've written, everything that I've appeared on, and so if you want to just keep track of my work, that is literally the simplest way. It's always all in one place at least once a month.
And people can read you, all your writing is found there?
Yeah, all my writing is found there. As you probably know, I write for a lot of I'm usually all over the place. But my home base in terms of outlets is usually rodreaper.com and the New York Times.
Fantastic. Well, I hope you have a good time at the New York Film Festival. I hope it isn't too taxing. And again, thank you so much. This was an absolute blast. Thank you, Robert.
Oh, thank you for having me. This was fantastic.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Bye.
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 Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hi, I'm Megan Rinks.
And I'm Melissa D. Montz.
And like every other person with access to a microphone, we started a podcast.
On Mondays, we release Don't Blame Me, which is an advice podcast where listeners call in and we share our thoughts on situations such as what to do if you're going to your boyfriend's family function and you haven't told him that you previously slept with both his twin brothers.
Then on Thursdays, we release our podcast, But Am I Wrong?, where we ethically gossip about pop culture, politics, our lives, and your lives. Listeners write in and we tell them if they're wrong or right in a situation. Are you the hero or the villain?
On Tuesdays and Fridays, we throw in a little something extra as well.
A little something, something. We strive to create a community grounded in activism, mental health, and inclusivity. Think of us as like your blunt, honest friends who give you advice that you need to hear, not what you want to hear. But we're also always rooting for your success. What we lack in credentials, we make up for in
opinions.
We do that in every episode too.
We're professional, unprofessional. So if you're looking for a new slate of podcasts to add to your routine, we're here for you.
Acast recommends.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.